from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Although it has indignantly challenged the accusations leveled against it numerous times over the years as a near sacrilege, the newly announced plan for a Palestinian-only town to be built in Israel is being cited by critics as proof that Israel is an apartheid state. According to Israeli media outlets, the city is to be constructed near the coastal city of Acre at the northern extremity of Haifa Bay. Officials say the plans call for the new city to have a population of about 40,000. But Palestinians say the establishment of a city for a specific population group is not ethical and it should be open to all ethnic groups. Press TV's Mona Kandila reports from Ramallah.
As you know, Palestinians who are still living in Israel since the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories in 1948, they do not have the same rights that Israelis are having in what's so-called the state of Israel. It's for the first time since the establishment of Israel after occupying Palestinian territories in 1948, the Israeli authorities are considering a plan to build a new Arab city. Only Arabs will be living there to accommodate more than 40,000 people. According to this Israeli plan that will be submitted to the Israeli Regional Council for Planning and Building this week for endorsement, they will be dividing between the Jewish people and the Palestinians, Arabs, who are still living in Israel. They want to put the Israelis only in own neighborhoods without any Arabs living there.
The Israeli Housing and Construction Ministry has reportedly been working on the plan for the past 4 years. The decision to build the city was reportedly made during a cabinet meeting in 2008. The UN Security Council will hold an emergency meeting Wednesday over Israel's plans to build more illegal settlements in the occupied Palestinian lands. The meeting of the 15-member council was requested by Jordan following a letter from the Palestinian envoy to the UN, Ambassador Riyad Mansour, who stressed the need to, quote, address this crisis situation in occupied East Jerusalem, close quote. The request came after Israel announced plans to build 1,060 new settler units in East Jerusalem. Mary Hughes Thompson, co-founder of the Free Gaza Movement from Los Angeles, said in an interview with Press TV that Israel feels as long as the U.S. supports what it doesn't have to fear any criticism or condemnation from any country in the world.
It does seem very strange that Israel does not seem to be concerned about the international condemnation. It would appear that the only thing that can change the situation or stop Israel's continuing to build settlements is if the United States changes its position. And so far, there's been very little sign that they're willing to do that. So it seems as though Netanyahu feels so long as the United States supports what he does, he doesn't have to fear any kind of criticism or condemnation from any country in the world. And even when the United States makes these comments about settlement building being unhelpful to the peace process, it seems as if it's just lip service. I think they probably speak on the phone first, and Obama or someone in the State Department tells Netanyahu, well, you know, we're going to have to comment, but don't worry about it. It doesn't mean anything. We're not going to do anything, which, of course, they never do anything. So I think this is why it continues and why it will continue into the foreseeable future and indefinitely, and something happens to change our position and our continued financing of everything Israel wants to do.
Meanwhile, as if to prove the point, a vote at the UN General Assembly once again saw almost the entire world community vote overwhelmingly in favor of ending the blockade of Cuba by the United States. This year, 188 of the 193 member countries voted in favor of a resolution calling for an end to the illegal blockade. The only two nations to vote against it were the U.S. and Israel. There were three abstentions: the Pacific Island nations of Palau, Marshall Islands, and Micronesia. The financial crisis that has plagued Europe for the past 6 years has plunged more than 2.5 million children in the richest countries alone into poverty, That according to the UN's International Children's Emergency Fund, or UNICEF. Stephanie Kutrix reports from the United Nations.
Millions more children were plunged into poverty in the world's most affluent countries due to the 2008 financial crisis, according to the UN Children's Fund, UNICEF. A new report released by UNICEF on the impact of the economic crisis on child well-being ranks 41 countries in the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, known as OECD, and the European Union. It specifically looks at whether levels of child poverty have increased or decreased between 2008 and 2012. Ekaterina Shizen is a social and economic policy specialist at UNICEF.
We estimate that overall there are 2.6 million children more who are poor in 2012 than in 2008. And overall, we have an estimated 76.5 million children who live in poverty in the world's richest countries.
Ms. Shizen added that overall, child poverty increased in 23 out of the 41 countries, with rates rising by over 50% in Ireland, Croatia, Latvia, Greece, and Iceland. The report also shows that in Greece in 2012, median household incomes for families with children sank to 1998 levels, the equivalent of a loss of 14 years of income progress. By this same measure, Ireland, Luxembourg, and Spain lost a decade. Stephanie Kutrix, United Nations.
And there likely won't be much relief in the form of pennies for UNICEF from trick-or-treaters in the U.S. this year, where child poverty has increased in 34 out of 50 states since the start of the crisis in 2008. In 2012, 24.2 million children in the United States were living in poverty, with more than one in three children in both New York and California now living below the poverty line. But it's not only children stuck in poverty in the U.S. who are apparently facing tough times. To hear them tell it, the wealthy CEOs who are largely blamed for the crisis are also having a hard time making ends meet. One of the biggest beneficiaries of the taxpayers' generosity in the wake of the crash in 2008 was insurance giant AIG, whose former CEO, Hank Greenberg, has filed a $40 billion lawsuit against the U.S. government, claiming that the $184.6 billion AIG bailout was not enough. Liberation Radio's Ernesto Aguilar gave this report.
In a trial that began September 29th, Hank Greenberg, former CEO of insurance giant AIG, is suing the government for an additional $40 billion on top of the $164 billion AIG received. He contends the government did not give AIG as much as others. For more, we go to Walter Smolarek, who wrote about the case for Liberation News. He lays out the facts.
The case is currently, it's in court. It's a civil suit filed by Hank Greenberg, who is the former CEO of AIG, which is, as listeners may remember, was a huge insurance firm that went bankrupt at the beginning of the current economic crisis. So AIG was bailed out with a tremendous amount of money, $186 billion ultimately. And so what Hank Greenberg is doing is suing the government for an additional $40 billion, believe it or not. So his argument is that the terms that were imposed on AIG as part of the bailout. Basically, the government bought 80% of this failing, totally bankrupt company. And so, the capitalists were able to save 20% of their assets, more or less. And then also the loans that AIG were given by the government, which, of course, they couldn't have gotten anywhere else because it was a completely bankrupt company. Had a higher interest rate than they did with other financial firms, like basically all of the major banks got better treatment than AIG. So, I mean, it's really like the height of arrogance that he would try to bring this lawsuit against the government and demand an additional $40 billion. It may be true that other financial entities were given more favorable bailouts conditions, but that misses the fundamental point that the bailouts of the big banks and corporations was a tremendous crime against poor and working people and financed by poor and working people's tax money.
Could you put this in the context of how many of these banks and other firms who benefited from the bailouts have approached public criticism?
The banks have more or less refused to tell us how they use the money. There was a scandal, I forget which year, but there was several years ago, the banks gave tremendous bonuses to their CEOs. You know, actually, I remember it was 2009. So right after the crisis really began in earnest and the bailouts were given mostly at the end of 2008. So AIG gave $165 million of bonuses to its executives in March of 2009. So that's just a few months after the bailout. So really, I mean, it's just been insult after insult. You know, there's been no accountability whatsoever for the CEOs for the crimes that they committed, you know, crashing the entire world economy. And they've just been content to continue with business as usual, giving themselves tremendous compensation packages and exploiting the earth and the people.
Where do you see this case going as it winds through the courts?
You know, I don't see this being successful. It's interesting because, you know, the state, it's sometimes called like the executive committee of the capitalist class, right? So, you know, capitalists all have a fundamentally the same interest in maintaining the system of capitalism. But oftentimes they get into disputes with each other. There is lots of divisions within the capitalist class. And so they have these apparatuses like courts to settle that, right? And, you know, the court system that the ruling class gets to face is considerably different than the court system for poor and working people where, you know, it's one of the main engines of racist mass incarceration. This is like nice ruling class courts. I think that the government will be successful just because of the patent absurdity of the case. And so an interesting side effect of this is that all of the main architects of the bailout, Hank Paulson, Ben Bernanke, the major economic officials of the capitalist state, are being called to testify in this case because the government needs to establish that the terms that they imposed on AIG were in fact not punitive but aimed at helping AIG. So, like Ben Bernanke said that our intervention would spare it the discipline of the market, it being AIG. So I think it's actually very illuminating how this case has sort of shown what the government was trying to do, and it's very clear that they were trying to save the big banks and save the system of big banking, of capitalism.
As we reported earlier, Pennsylvania's state legislature unanimously enacted a law censoring the voices of those incarcerated within its prisons, a law that even its authors admit was intended to target imprisoned journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal. Brett Grote is a lawyer with the Abolitionist Law Center. He spoke with Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford.
197-0 is the sort of support that you only see from a legislative body, say, if it's the U.S. Congress supporting the Israeli state and its onslaught on the Palestinians. It's that degree of submissiveness and servility to the Fraternal Order of Police did raise my eyebrows, especially when the bill itself is transparently unconstitutional for a number of reasons. It really, I think, should serve as a wake-up call to those who feel that a Democratic-Republican convergence of interests in lowering the cost of mass incarceration is anything other than a total sham for maintaining the status quo. When you see them line up behind the Fraternal Order of Police like this and attack Mumia in a symbolic way in order to reestablish the narrative of who the police are and what their function is, I think it should serve as a wake-up call to which side those in power are really on.
We've been hearing Mumia's voice and reading his writings for years now. Prison Radio have been promulgating his message weekly for years. What set off the Pennsylvania government that they would go into a kind of legislative hysteria?
It was ostensibly his being invited to give a commencement speech to a graduating class at Goddard College in Vermont. He has done this before in 2008. He's also given commencement speeches at Antioch College and, I believe, Evergreen in Washington State. These had never produced this type of concerted effort to shut him down, and so I think there's other factors that are at play here, one of those being Governor Corbett's failing political prospects for re-election. He's at risk of becoming the first one-term governor in the state of Pennsylvania since the 70s or the 60s. So he has latched on to Mumia giving this commencement address as a way to try to engage in a standard trope for Pennsylvania politicians, which is race baiting, fear mongering around issues of crime, and using Mumia as somebody to beat up on for political gain. But I also think what I had alluded to before, the Fraternal Order of Police has a national agenda, and when they want to advance it, they oftentimes do it by targeting the person of Mumia. They did this when Barack Obama recently nominated somebody to head the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department that they did not want, and they connected the NAACP Legal Defense Fund's representation of Mumia Abu-Jamal and his challenge to his conviction and sentence in a way to smear him. And they are very much frantically trying to reestablish the lie that police forces are the protectors of public safety and that other institutions of violence, such as prisons, are necessary to protect the public. And in the wake of Ferguson, it is more necessary than ever for them to do this, as the role of these institutions are being criticized perhaps more than they have been in a generation.
This seems to be a new kind of species of law. It makes legally actionable prisoner speech that causes what they call mental anguish among the families of victims of crime.
Correct. The conduct at issue is defined solely in relation to its effect on the victim. It is written so broadly that it can include everything from a prisoner appealing for commutation to a former offender perhaps engaging in public speech on the airwaves or doing anything which is likely to cause mental anguish. It could relate to somebody proclaiming their innocence, to somebody protesting conditions of confinement inside of the prisons, and it is explicitly designed to target otherwise lawful speech. The state of Pennsylvania has tried to silence Mumia in the past, obviously by trying to kill him, and the 1990s, however, the prison system itself imposed a restriction against him that he is not to practice a profession, and they tried to shut him down that way. Mumia went into federal court in a case called Abu-Jamal v. Price, and he beat that regulation back, even under the relaxed standards for First Amendment rights that are afforded to prisoners. So the conduct at issue here is as wide as the universe of human conduct possible, and the only definitive characteristic under the statute is that it has to cause some type of mental anguish on the victim. And as the very mainstream Harrisburg Patriot newspaper noted, for many victims, the fact that the offender is still breathing, it causes mental anguish. And so this conduct of breathing could, under the text of the law, allow them to go into court to try to get an injunction against that conduct. It's clearly absurd on its face.
And what about those who facilitate this transmission of mental anguish? People like yourself, people like me, people out there who reproduce the words and speech of prisoners of Pennsylvania.
In the House Judiciary Committee, when there was discussion over the scope of a court's powers under this law, those who drafted the bill clearly indicated that they intended for a court to be able to enjoin the conduct of what they referred to as third-party vessels. So Prison Radio, Black Agenda Report, Democracy Now!, or any number of prison abolitionists or prisoner rights organizations that work with people inside prison and publicize their statements. Under this law, they can face a court order prohibiting them from transmitting, broadcasting, or otherwise disseminating messages that the court has deemed cause mental anguish.
So with the help of the state of Pennsylvania, the families of people who feel they have been victimized by people in prison can reach out and actually throttle the speech of virtually any other American.
Correct. It totally eviscerates the First Amendment for anybody that has been convicted of a personal injury crime. It can be members of the private bar working with victims as their personal attorneys to take this on, or, as is more likely, the district attorney where the crime was committed, or the state attorney general. In what is another unusual aspect of this law, it allows for state officials to essentially act as the private attorneys for the victims and use taxpayer money to bring an injunctive suit in state court.
What are the prospects of this law being upheld constitutionally, and does Pennsylvania care?
Well, the Pennsylvania legislature clearly does not care, and their reputation for lawlessness is beyond the scope of this interview, but it's quite considerable. Myself and with the Abolitionist Law Center and the Amistad Law Project in Philadelphia and some others are preparing to challenge this in court, and it would require a drastic rewriting of a number of key First Amendment principles and precedents in order for this to be upheld. So we're quite confident. The ACLU of Pennsylvania even stated in a memo to legislators that the only people who will benefit from this bill are the attorneys who are successful in federal court in getting it struck down. So, you know, attorneys can tend to be a cautious breed in predicting how likely they are to win in any piece of litigation, but they felt confident enough in making that quite definitive statement about the prospects of the bill.
And have the folks at Prison Radio made any changes in their day-to-day operations dealing with Mumia and other prisoners in light of this law?
No, but since there has been this push, there have been, if anything, more broadcasts from Prison Radio, quote, interviewing Mumia and his own responses to it, and just a further dedication to continue to bring the voices of prisoners to the broader public discussions about mass incarceration, about white supremacy, about torture and solitary confinement and other things related to the criminal legal system. So there's been no changes, and there has been, if anything, a renewed commitment and even increased output in the wake of this latest provocation.
As we reported earlier, this past Friday, Black Agenda Report held its annual get-together at Riverside Church in New York City. Among the many speakers was Black Agenda Report's Bruce Dixon.
We're talking about the black misleadership class here, the black political class, and how they need to be challenged and confronted and stood up to and acknowledged for what they actually are. And every year in September, the Congressional Black Caucus, which is the whatever it is that rises to the top of our black political class, you tell me what floats on top, I don't know. The cream of our black political class gathers in Washington, D.C., for a week of what it calls brain trust sessions and leadership conferences and whatnot. And we've been wondering for a little while why nobody ever confronts them. And this year, some young people who are residing in D.C. Stood up and did that. And we've got Ms. Asantewa Krumah-Ture. No, stand up. Ain't no waving. Stand up. And there's a brother here named Kenny also who had a part in it also. And they stood up and challenged the Congressional Black Caucus for its uncritical support of apartheid in Israel, its subservience to the telecoms, and its general thing here. But we've got a lot to go because the week afterwards, the Congressional Hispanic Caucus met in the same place. And you know what those Latino brothers and sisters did? They not only had a demonstration outside like we did, they sent some people inside and they disrupted President Obama's address. They did that. They did that. So we got a ways to go. Our black political class of preachers, of politicians, of pundits and media people, of professional and business types, have made an historic deal with the devil. It's a deal every bit as short-sighted and every bit as destructive as the deal that Booker T and his crew made five generations ago in the 1890s, maybe six generations, depending on how you count that, right? Their deal was that they would get white philanthropy to run black schools and colleges, staffed largely by blacks, which would turn out an industrious and a docile black working class and black yeoman farmers under the leadership of some black professionals and preachers. Out of gratitude and obligation for being those designated leaders, Booker and the boys, and it was 1890-something, so they were all boys, Booker and the boys agreed that there would be no disturbing the economic and social peace for at least a generation or two. And during this time, our great-great-grandparents, or if you're a little younger than me, if you're Kenny's age, you might have to add another couple of greats in there, they were supposed to be pulling themselves up to respectable prosperity without questioning segregation, which was everywhere, and without agitating about the vote, which had been taken away two generations earlier at the end of Reconstruction, and without combining into labor or farmers' unions to conduct class warfare on their own behalves. The bargain worked fine for Booker and his crew. They became the de facto political leaders of black America. They became the prosperous conduits through which public patronage and private philanthropy flowed. Booker and his boys essentially got what was promised to them and to their class. But of course, the black masses, well, they never did get any land. And what's a yeoman farmer called without land? In America, he's called a sharecropper. In Mexico, he's called a peon. You know, so they never also didn't get any relief from segregation. Matter of fact, when relief from segregation finally did come, it was under the leadership of folks generations later who pretty much repudiated Booker's bargain and who were only able to achieve what they did achieve due to international contingencies. I mean, the U.S. looked bad while fighting Nazis and enforcing Jim Crow at home. And it looked bad later on, beating and murdering civil rights workers and suppressing urban rebellions while it was wrestling with the Soviets and the Chinese for influence in Africa and Asia. When you strike a deal with the devil, somebody always pays a big price. Isn't that the way the story goes? Well, Booker's bargain delayed and diverted our struggle for social and economic rights for at least two, maybe three generations. And many people alive today are still paying the prices for that. Now, it's not like all this time the older heads were doing nothing. Okay, back in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, they were filing case after case after case against segregation. But the collective leadership mindset of the 1940s and the 50s black America, and well into the 60s, was one that put our people's number one hope in the decisions of white judges, judicial intervention, and the limited black vote, because of course only black folks in the North could vote. Black folks in the South couldn't vote. And so this is where the leadership was in the 40s and 50s. They used to call Thurgood Marshall Mr. Civil Rights. That was also the era, by the way, which defined our people's struggle as a struggle for civil rights, not economic rights, not human rights, civil rights. And that was kind of that definition was a measure of the deal that the black leadership class of that era struck. You know, this kind of black leadership bargain that succeeded Booker T. But it was only finally in the times and in the places where young people in the 60s and the 70s and to some extent the 50s also finally disregarded the counsel of the old heads. And they started disrespecting their elders. They started breaking the law. They started sitting in. They started filling the jails. And by the 60s, they started picking up the gun and organizing self-defense. The Voting Rights Act only happened when young SNCC workers ignored the old heads and launched rural organizing projects.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.